It is in dialogue that we justify ourselves. The scriptures are very clear about this behavior. The dialectic process simply is all that's of the world: the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, which is only of the world. That's John, 1 John 2:16. And it's not of the Father. The Father comes into the room with two things: commands, rules, facts, and truth, and enforcement. Now, the heart is the heart of the issue. Scriptures, Luke 16:15, and he said unto them, ye are they which justify yourself before men, but God knows your hearts, for that which is highly esteemed among men is abomination in the sight of God. And what is highly esteemed among men? The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. Now, this is all tied to the material world. We have a chemical in us called dopamine. It's simply called a neurotransmitter in that it's a chemical that is emancipated, and that's the term they use, or liberated from one nerve, goes through a little gap called a synaptic gap, hits a receptor on the next nerve, which then sends a electrical current up to the next gap. And in that gap, this neurotransmitter is emitted. All habitual drugs are tied to dopamine. Some release it, some keep it in the synaptic gap, others keep it retained on the other side, and some imitate it. And so it's simply pleasure. So the lust of the flesh is the environment that stimulates dopamine emancipation. Lust of the eyes is us looking into the environment and imagining or thinking upon what stimulates dopamine, and that stimulates dopamine. And the pride of life is simply getting satisfaction or dopamine from controlling the environment. You control the situation, you control the object, the people, the person. The child is not in love with a toy. The child is in love with the dopamine the toy stimulates. This is the message of the preacher: vanity, vanity, all is vanity. And so when we come together and we justify ourselves, we justify ourselves before one another, it's all about dopamine emancipation. Now the heart, Jeremiah 17:9 says, the heart is deceitful above all things. Now, we're deceived because we have made pleasure, dopamine emancipation, the purpose of life, instead of doing the Father's will. The carnal heart is not subject to doing the Father's will. It is approach pleasure and avoid pain. So if pleasure is the standard of life, then the heart is desperately wicked, in that whoever takes that pleasure away, or is perceived as taking that pleasure away, then the child, you know, the two-year-old, again, thank God they don't have a gun, because they would shoot you, they would kill you, shaking that fist, that stare at you. It's desperately wicked, and who can know it? And this is Karl Marx's statement, not being feeling at home in a sinful world, critical criticism. It's not criticism of you just talking, well, Joe doesn't treat me right, and if I could do, it is hate. You start with dissatisfaction. And the more you dialogue with yourself, then it becomes resentment. And the more you dialogue with yourself, then it becomes hate. And who can know it? We can't see our hate towards authority as being wicked, because our lust for pleasure is standing in the way. Matthew 7:21-23, for from within, out of the heart of men, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lasciviousness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. All these evils come from within and defile the man. For men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents. Wow, that used to stick out for me as a child. Unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those who are good, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God, having a form of godliness. In other words, there's a way that seemeth right unto man. In this 10th chapter of Romans, Paul writes, not knowing the righteousness of God, they have established their own righteousness, therefore not fulfilling the righteousness of God. Now, I'm paraphrasing, but that's what he's... The message of all of philosophy and psychology and sociology is man establishing what is righteous, what is right. And he can only do that from the creation. Because it's God who tells us, it is written, it is written, it is written. Man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word which proceedeth from the mouth of God. And so having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof, from such turn away. For the wicked boasts of his heart's desire, and blesses the covetous, whom the Lord abhorreth. The wicked, through the pride of his countenance, will not seek after God. God is not in all his thoughts. Even George Washington, of all people, recognized this. He wrote in his farewell address, despotism predominates in the human heart. That's why we used to have checks and balances on government. But now government gets a diverse group of people dialoguing to consensus over social issues in a facilitated meeting, and they circumvent the patriarchal structure. They circumvent accountability to the Constitution, accountability to God. Of lust. Scriptures are very clear. James 4, 1 through 3, for from within, from whence comes wars and fighting among you? Come they not hence, even your lusts that war in your members? You lust and have not. You kill and desire to have and cannot obtain. You fight and war, yet you have not because you ask not. You ask and receive not because you ask amiss, that you may consume it unto your own lusts. But every man is tempted. This is James 1, 14 and 15. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lusts and enticed. Then when lust has conceived, it brings forth sin. And sin, when it is finished, brings forth death. Well, this whole process is built upon the here and now. The man's natural inclination to lust after the carnal pleasures of the moment that the world stimulates, that the situation and or the people or the object or the person stimulates, to approach that pleasure, and then to resent and reject and hate that which gets in the way. This again is the driving force behind the child going why to the parent's command. Now, the difference in the language we use, discussion and dialogue, the key to Marxism is being able to talk to yourself and everybody else without bringing God up in your conversation, without bringing accountability to authority other than man's carnal nature. And that's the element of dialogue. Nothing wrong with dialogue when you're in the domain that you've been told you can participate, you can do. You can eat of all these trees. That's what God said. You can eat of all the trees in the garden. And therefore, you can dialogue. I like this. I don't like that. And I feel good here. I don't feel good looking at this. You know, it's all subjective. But when God gave that other, you know, the big print giveth and the small print taketh away, he threw in the small print. It was, you can't eat of that one. You can eat all these, but you can't eat of that one. So you can't bring dialogue there. To what God has said, you cannot bring dialogue. And that's what the woman did. The master facilitator of change encouraged her, said, oh, you won't be held accountable. See, in the classroom, we're not going to judge anybody. Let's be positive. Don't be negative. We're not going to judge, condemn, or kick anybody out. You can share whatever you feel like sharing. How do you feel? Well, I feel like I ought to touch it. Well, what do you think? Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. It's just like all the other trees. It's pleasing to the eyes. It's good for food. and is desirous to make one wise. Ah, now we have lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. And it's all because dialogue was brought into an environment where there's established commands, rules, facts, and truth. And in bringing dialogue in, there's no higher authority. It's all subjective. This is all psychology and sociology. It's all built on subjectivity. It's all built upon the feelings of man, his perception of the world. That's what the Bible says, having eyes they cannot see and ears they cannot hear. And so let's look at the definition of discussion and dialogue. Bohm and Pete in Science, Order, and Creativity write, in an ordinary discussion, people usually hold relatively fixed positions and argue in favor of those of their views as they try to convince others to change. And so it's right, wrong, black, white, sheep, goats, heaven, hell. And so it's by persuasion, by being told. But a dialogue is different. They write, a dialogue is essentially a conversation between equals. See why you as a child ask your parent why? Because if your parent, well, I think or I feel, you can go, I feel and I think. And you both have an opinion. You're both equal. Opinions make us all equal. You can always tell when you're talking to a liberal because whenever you tell them they're wrong, they'll say, well, that's just your opinion. And you say, well, no. You're wrong. Well, that's just your opinion. And you can stand there all day long. Because if a liberal ever admitted that he's wrong, he's no longer a liberal. When it comes to right and wrong behavior, God has set the standard. Everything else is of the creation. Lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, of pride of life is the standard of behavior apart from God. So in a world of dialogue, we're all equal. The spirit of dialogue isn't interesting. The spirit of dialogue is, in short, the ability to hold many points of view in suspension. Now, you can suspend everything of your opinion. But in this dialogue, you must suspend Christ on the cross. You have to. Dialogue demands it. The moment you're in a Bible study and you go, I feel and I think to a verse, you have suspended Christ on the cross and you have made yourself God. Man doesn't live by bread alone, but every word which proceedeth from the mouth of God. Not your minister. It is why you read the word. You study the word for yourself. Yes, it's good to be under teaching. That's sound doctrine. That weighs the word with a word. If whoever you're sitting under keeps going, I feel and I think, you've got a problem. You weigh the word with a word, line upon line and precept upon precept, because the word defines itself. And so again, the spirit of dialogue is, in short, the ability to hold many points of view in suspension along with a primary interest in the creation of common meaning. You're wanting to find what you have in common with the other person. And all you have in common with the other person in dialogue is the lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and pride of life. Isn't that brilliant? That all I have to do is get your child into a group and deal with moral issues, social issues, your standards, and ask them how they feel and what they think, and they will find commonality with the other students, and they will come home and attack your authority. I don't have to tell them to attack your authority. They're already doing, we do that. We don't like being restrained, being told what we can and can't do, but now it's become critical. It's critical theory. Critical criticism. There's a threshold we've gone over where now the child is justified himself before others. Jürgen Habermas, the Marxist, he writes, in the dialogic relation of recognizing oneself and the other, or there was recognizing your lust and the other person, they experience the common ground of their existence. So it's this lust for pleasure that is the driving force of life. And so the purpose of life is to augment, or create an environment where pleasure is liberated, lust is liberated, and the only way you can do that is to get rid of the Father's authority in the environment. And all we have to do when we come to town hall meeting, you get the leadership together and you ask one another how you feel, what you think. All the standards that you have set as a citizen, all the contract that restrains them is gone. It's circumvented. Then Lukacs, who came to the, he didn't come to the United States, but he started the Institute of Social Research, and these guys eventually came here, called the Frankfurt School, because that's where they eventually ended up before Hitler became chancellor. He writes, in fact, when he wrote back in 1921, 3 months before Lenin gives his speech, Lenin's speech sounds like he plagiarized George Lukacs, and when Stalin became, came in force, Lukacs had to recant to stay alive. But he and Antonio Gramsci were two key Marxists. Gramsci, they even put his stuff in comic book form so college students can enjoy themselves while they're learning Marxism. Only when the immediate interests are integrated into a total view, in other words, when I get the students together, the group grade, is they come to a consensus. So they get to a total view and related to the final goal of the process, and that is we can all fulfill, we can work on a project, build a bridge or whatever, but it's the group think. He writes, the process, do they become revolutionary? And what is a revolution? The overthrow of the Father's authority. The whole system of Marxism stands and falls upon with the principle that revolution, the negation of the Father's authority, is a product of a point of view in which the category of totality is dominant. In other words, that feeling of oneness. Consensus means with feeling. There's a feeling. It's our lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and pride of life that is now driving. Now, it used to be associated with capitalism, and certainly is. But now, it's no longer just the individual. It is the collective. And the capitalist didn't just go out and shoot whoever wouldn't work for him. These guys will. That's why there's so much violence in the world beyond the norm. And Habermas then writes, revolutionary violence reconciles the disunited parties. In other words, it's the parent who sets a standard over the children. Say if I have 20 students in my classroom, come from different homes. Those students have different standards, and they don't get along with one another. And so it's the parents that created the division. So if I ask the students how they feel, what they think, that's what they have in common. I can find commonality, communism. Communism is a result of us putting aside our differences, find what we have in common. And what do we have in common? Lust of flesh, lust of the eyes, pride of life. Karl Marx's sense of experience, sensuous needs, sense perception. They just make it sound academic, but it's all spiritual. So this violence, this overthrow of the Father's authority, reconciles the disunited parties by abolishing the alienation of class antagonism. In other words, this top-down, right-wrong, that set in with the repression of initial morality. What's the initial morality? Lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, pride of life. Sigmund Freud called it Eros. The revolution that must occur is the reaction of suppressed life. It's stimulus response. What's the heart? If pleasure is a standard, then it's desperately wicked to retain that lust for the flesh, lust of the eyes, and pride of life. So it's a reaction of suppressed life, which will visit the causality of fate upon the rulers, upon the parents, upon whoever it is. This is the French Revolution. They sent people to the guillotines on this principle. It is those who establish such domination and defend positions of power of this sort. In other words, a patriarchal paradigm. If you defend right is right and wrong is wrong and you're not going to move. Who set in motion the causality of fate. Divide society into social classes, suppress justified interests, call forth the reaction, and this is the justification here now, call forth the reaction of suppressed life, and finally experience their just fate in revolution. And Lukács says, the Communist Manifesto makes the point that the bourgeoisie, that's the patriarchal, that's the people who are loyal to the king. And we resolve the king issue with a Bill of Rights. Who's the king? It's no longer a man up there. Well, it is today. But it wasn't intended that way. It was the father in the home. See, it's private business, private convictions, private property. Those the father. It's the father in the home. There is no one. There's a one. See, there's when you have two fathers, now you can play the game. But with one father, just like call no man father on earth, you have one father which in heaven. It's that there's one I'm accountable to. And so we as individuals are accountable to this one. And we may not understand all that he tells us. But there's this understanding you're accountable to a higher authority. And so the old agenda, and that's the bourgeoisie. And so the Communist Manifesto was this one point. The bourgeoisie produces its own grave diggers. That's the children. The Bible talks about the children will kill the parents. That's what this is all about. But it's because the proletariat are the children. That the spirit of the child of disobedience. I won't do what the king tells me to do because I want to do what I want to do. Now, the king can be wrong. He can be a tyrant. But it's the office they're going after. And so, what is this consensus process? This is classic by Irvin Laszlo. The climate control, the climate change, this is his book. He wrote it, A Strategy for the Future, the Systems Approach to World Order. He laid out the whole agenda that we're now living in. Irvin Laszlo. And here's what he writes in this book. Bypassing, circumventing, see, going around the traditional channels of top-down decision-making. I get your legislator, I get your minister, Minister's Alliance. What do? You dialogue. Cooking your minister, cooking your legislator, cooking your children, cooking your police. French Revolution, they had to restructure all the parishes because the sheriff is the most powerful office in the nation. And so they had to restructure because the sheriff's conscience is to the local culture. That if I take your sheriff and have him dialogue to consensus with sheriffs across county and across the state and across the nation, you have just lost the sheriff whose conscience is to your culture of your community. That's why they had to restructure everything, to undo the effect of loyalty to an authority above the conscience. So how do you have to bypass decision-making? Our objective centers upon transformation of public opinion into an effective instrument of global policies or politics. Individual values must be measured by their contribution to common interests, common lusts. Building relationship on what? Self-interest, on lust, and ultimately to world interests. Transforming public consensus into one favorable to the emergence of a stable and humanistic worldview or world order. See, I just say what they want is worldly peace and socialist harmony. Consensus is both a personal and political step. It is a precondition of all future steps. The group grade is simply every child learning to come to consensus and sacrifice the truth, putting Jesus on the cross. You can't come to consensus without putting Christ on the cross. Period. Your child has learning skills. Your child has potential. Who's learning skills? Is it the Lord directing his steps? Not in this process, not even possible. And so Kenneth Benet in Human Relations and Curriculum Change, he writes, we must develop persons who see non-influenceability of private convictions. In other words, they're going to say this is right and that's wrong. Black is black, white is white. In joint deliberation, in a meeting of consensus, as a vice rather than a virtue. So you take your child, and you put your child in this dialoguing to a consensus group grade, and your child holds to your standards, holds to God's standards. The agenda is to martyr him. He has to be martyred for the sake of the group. the life raft dilemma. You have to kill somebody. You either kill yourself or you kill someone else. You have to commit murder. And so you practice getting rid of the witness of God's word. He's standing in the way of progress. What's this power of the group? The individual, Norman O. Brown in Life Against Death, he writes, the individual is emancipated in a social group. You teach your children standards, and then you go with relatives and you circumvent those standards for the sake of the relationship. And your children see it. Double standard. And Kurt Lewin in Benet's book, he writes, it is usually easier to change individuals formed into a group than to change any one of them separately. The individual accepts the new system of values and beliefs by accepting belongingness to the group. Yalom says, it's amazing. They're born again. They're born again in the group. Their identity is with the group, the relationship. Kurt Lewin in Resolving Social Conflicts, Selected Papers on Group Dynamics, he writes, the group to which an individual belongs is the group for his perception, his feelings, and his actions. And so the agenda was changing the environment. So you control the environment, you control the person. Kurt Lewin in Wilbur Brooker's book, Sociology of Education, he writes, the child takes on the characteristic behavior of the group in which he is placed. He reflects the behavior patterns which are set by the adult leaders of the group. You bring in a traditional teacher, black is black, white is white, yes, no. You're right, you're wrong. You produce a particular child. But if you bring in a facilitator of change, the master facilitator of change was in the Garden of Eden. You cannot be a facilitator of change without following his identical pattern. How do you feel? What do you think? Change in methods of leadership is probably the greatest way to bring about a change in the cultural atmosphere of a group. Any real change of the culture of a group is therefore interwoven with the changes of power constellation within the group. This is the youth group leader. You know, getting along with the kids, having a good time. Now, I'm not against that. But they're there to study the Word of God. Period. Well, we'll pick up tomorrow.